We are ready to dive into the ocean of Belarusian unknown context. And here we are again, Tony Lajden.
Hi, very nice to see you, Andrei.
And Andrei Zavalei. We are both coming from Belarus, and our aim today, and as always, is uncover the curtain of very complex reality of Belarus.
I completely forgot that we're doing this in English. And for the moment, I had the most weird type of experience when I was like, why the fuck are we talking in English? And what type of a weird flex this is. But then I remembered, yeah, that the purpose of this was to do this in English. Yeah, very weird 10 seconds of my life.
Well, that's part of our everyday life. You are basically waking up in the morning and then you realize, I should regroup, I should mobilize myself, I should organize. And the level of those responsibilities is sometimes overwhelming. And exactly, we are forced to speak in English because that's the only way we can knock at the door of the Western societies, Western communities, and to try to deliver the message. The actual knowledge and the experience we actually have might be crucial for the global development, global geopolitical situation as well, because I would say I have a strong belief that if we would try to look into details, which is sometimes small, unknown, unnecessary, unwanted countries like Belarus, we can discover some secrets of like what is solution in the frames of the global challenges. It might sound very dramatic. Sometimes I really might be over-exaggerating, or it feels like it's, come on, it's not so relevant. You are just whatever the country in the frames of the Russian influence. And that's why, for instance, your iPhone doesn't have Belarusian interface. My favorite word, I mean, it's a joke, it's an irony. My favorite word is the market. We are considered as part of the Russian influence, and economical dependence of Belarus is so high that even corporations don't feel like designing a Belarusian interface for their devices, which is being sold in the market of the Eastern Bloc.
But I also find it quite peculiar that, yeah, there is no Belarusian interface for iPhone, because Belarus used to have 10 million of population, which is, for example, twice as much as people have in Lithuania, twice as much as people have in Latvia. And for some reason, those two countries have their own interfaces. So I'm also, you know, thinking that it's not only related to the external view of geopolitics, but also I think it speaks a lot about the Russian influence and how Russia perceives Belarus, and what type of political and economic relations are there, and which type of them Belarus inhabits.
Well, exactly. The favorite topic I still have is the neo-colonial picture of the world. And I'm watching quite a lot of documentaries about the Nazi Empire, about the Soviet Empire. And I would say, unfortunately, Belarus is never mentioned. So, for instance, when we speak about the Second World War, and those documentaries are being produced just recently by the British company, Ukraine is mentioned a few times. Because obviously now it's the next level of understanding what actually Soviet Union was. But Belarus is still not considered as the subject, as the entity in this whole context, because we are still under the huge influence of Russia. And basically, I would repeat myself, it's a hybrid occupation, because legally Belarus acts as a sovereign state, but de facto there is not a single decision being made without this strong order, consultancy, or like approval by Moscow. And for me, this very question of the market is like, okay, the country is not exactly a subject, the country is not exactly an entity. Why would we then contribute so much energy into developing a Belarusian interface for the iPhone? Because we are thinking about the profits and maximization of the immediate profit. We don't really think too much about the sustainable, and it's also about the environment, it's about the social issues being imposed by the neoliberal capitalistic structure of the world. But exactly, on the one hand, it's our responsibility as Belarusians to fight for it, demand it, and like saying like it's for us crucially important, for instance, as for Latvian people and Lithuanian people, even though they're even smaller than Belarus, but they have this privilege of recognition of their own language. And in our case, we didn't manage to establish the national state as it is considered to, with all the indicators of the nation state. And thus, why would other outer forces give us this recognition? It is a little bit overwhelming for the small entity, like a human being, find themselves in this situation like, I didn't fight enough for some basic recognition of my very existence. Okay, what should I do then?
For me, all of this is a part of the neo-capitalist system, right? Which is built upon the nation states, which typically exploit resources of former colonies. And then that is how the generational wealth is accumulated in these nation states, which were established during the modernity. So for me, it's not really, a given that having a well-developed nation state is something that Belarusians should strive for. I'm quite sure, actually, that right now, we would mostly benefit from having a more inclusive, stateless type of world. I mean, the more we analyze what is happening in the global north, the more we see that the states, as they were emergent in late 19th or beginning of 20th century, these states become more and more conservative. They are inhibited by far-right politicians right now. And the agenda that those political forces typically push for is closing the borders, instating one unified local culture and local language, and so on. So for me, really, this doesn't really speak to any of the values I have. I would rather see Belarus like as an open state. Of course, it's like a super utopian type of thinking. It would be good to have it, but realistically speaking, when we have Russia as this type of terrorist state, which is constantly looking for land to occupy, people to incorporate, and resources to exploit. Of course, with such neighbor in the picture, I don't think it's possible to have Belarus as open concept. Let's put it like that. But thinking in terms of like political utopians, I don't really like if we would need to have a political agenda tomorrow to build our own queer party, I wouldn't really push for the nation state. I really think that, so many other people have tried to build a nation state and we can learn from these particular lessons, how it went, what type of results they brought, what are the challenges right now. And we don't really necessarily need to repeat the same type of pathway to arrive to a destination we want to be. So, however, I think what is important, I actually wanted to reflect upon our internalized type of concept that Belarus is a small country, Belarusians are a small ethnos, and so on. I actually think that this is a part of the larger discourse of this little brothers discourse that Russia has been propaganding for so many years. If you compare Belarus, as I said, to like neighboring countries, Latvia, Lithuania. For example, I lived in Georgia for quite a while. So if you compare Belarus and Georgia, Belarus is like, in terms of land, almost four times more than Georgia. And in terms of population, again, almost four times more. And yet, I haven't had a single Georgian person saying that, Georgia is a small land. There is simply no notion that they are living in a small land. And same for Armenia and same for example, Azerbaijan. Like, these countries do not consider themselves small. Again, I think this is something which has been created only in comparison to Russia and because of Russian influence. And this notion of, Belarus being small, Belarus being insignificant, this is something that is a huge part of this Slavic brotherhood type of thing that Russia has been pushing for. Because I think once Belarusians will recognize that we are actually a very tangible power, both in terms of like geopolitics, but also like culturally speaking. I mean, 10 millions of people, imagine 10 billions of people like speaking the same language. That's fucking crazy. It's a lot of people speaking the language. But while there is no internal recognition that Belarus actually is significant, I don't really think that's possible to challenge this discourse.
Those smaller, bigger, it's all comparative, of course. It's all relativizing, of course. The indicator which helps us to identify it sometimes depends not exactly on your inner victories you achieved in order to have this recognition, but also the global geopolitical spectrum directly dictates whether you are recognized or neglected. And I would be a little bit more specific about this geopolitical situation around Belarus, which has been always in the middle of geopolitical global fights and Berlin Wall, Cold War, Second World War, Napoleon War, the First World War. It was always on the forefront in between of these two global bipolar forces. And in this regard, I would like to use as an example the case of Finland. For instance, Finland got its independence in 1917, independence from Russian Empire, the same empire that was occupying Belarus as well, and many, many other countries. So Finland managed to establish its own national state in 1917. And at the same period of time, it was Belarusian People's Republic, Ukrainian People's Republic announced, and for a few years we also legally existed in this very geopolitical, I don't know, mess. But then both Belarus and Ukraine were smashed by the red Bolshevik whatsoever communist evil. And it was, we were both forcefully integrated into the Soviet Union. So, and the example of Finland is proving it's possible to get yourself free from the empire. The very difference is Finland was directly supported by the Great Britain, or back then British Empire, right? It was officially announced that if Finland would be invaded by the Soviet army, it will immediately receive military support. And after that, it was clear like, we will not try to fight the British army in here. And then it brings me back to this question of, okay, we have two sides in every situation, and like both can contribute to the solution, to the change actually happening. And then sometimes I feel like being part of Belarus, being Belarusian citizen, I feel so much discouraged. Like, I feel this type of treatment, like, yeah, you are not strong enough. Your entity and your personal contribution is not enough to smash the dictatorship and to get rid of the Russian influence. You are just weak, right? Okay, and we are not giving you the Belarusian language interface for your iPhone. You just use the Russian one because you are such a nonsense subject.
Yeah, I simply imagine, you know, this type of logic. So you, weak Belarusians, you haven't counterattacked the Russian Empire. And that is why we will not give you the Belarusian interface. So this is kind of the crime and the punishment.
Well, it's the root and consequence.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, all the global situations are bringing you down to very small, in detail, disasters of every day. And exactly, I mean, Belarusians were fighting throughout this 200 years of Russian occupation, Russian invasion, Russian influence, constantly. And the amount of uprisings and conflicts and military conflicts is just immense. The difference is, exactly, Finland was, for some reason, recognized by the Western power as the unique individual sovereign entity. And that was the end of conversation. Even though in the 1939, when the Second World War began, Soviet Union tried actually to invade Finland because they were like, there is a huge mess happening and we can have a piece of this cake now. I mean, after Poland was already shared by the Nazi and Soviet forces. And what happened was Finland actually managed to defend their land with force. It was this Finnish Soviet war. Finland managed to protect, to defend, to sustain their sovereignty. And the Soviet army was really smashed. It was a big disaster for the Soviet military forces. The next episode of this introduction to the historical context for me is during the First World War, Belarus was again used as a platform, as how it's called, it's a battlefield for this pro-German and anti-German coalition. And what is for me hilarious and very sad and very dramatic is the Versailles Treaty was signed without a single representative from my country. So the new borders were established completely without any involvement, nobody actually asked us what do we want and who we are and what is our national identities is. All the questions we are raising now, here and now, as the Belarusian citizens, we're trying to still navigate ourselves and to find who we actually are and what is the direction of our development. And then there was a smaller peace treaty. It was a Brest-Litovsk treaty, in which exactly after Polish-Soviet war, again borders were like adjusted to the needs of two sides, which was Poland and Soviet Union, and again Belarus was excluded. We were not at the table of negotiations. And coming back to here and now and having no Belarusian language in the iPhone, I feel it's extremely unfair to blame the nation of Belarus for being weak. We tried hard. We did our best. And the same, I think, it's also fair in regards to the 2020s protest. We did everything we could and we failed. So what? You will not recognize our contribution if it's not a success?
You are listening to a special English edition of Quirilka podcast, supported by LGBTQfundandcircle.org, a British grassroots initiative who is currently building a network of activists around the globe fighting for equality. You can visit their website to become a part of the circle, to make a donation, to become a volunteer, or to find out more about what they do.
Yeah, right now, in terms of like how the global north sees the situation in Belarus, I think a lot of people are still under the illusion that mass protest can change things in authoritarian context. That, you know, when people go out, things change for some reason. Mm-hmm. And they expect that, I think, because that is their own experience. So, for example, if people are disappointed or dissatisfied with the state in Canada and they go out for massive protests in Canada, that sends a very strong signal to the authorities and they try to change things, right? But in Belarus, there is no communication. There is no dependency between these two things. So people go out in the streets, the state sees it, the state uses extreme force to suppress the mass protests, and that's basically it. So unless we understand that the power that the people and the state holds in Belarus is very different, it's very different level of power, very different access to resources, especially resources of violence and suppression and persecution. Unless we recognize that, I think it's very difficult to talk about any type of in-depth comprehension of what is happening in Belarus. Mm-hmm. So we can ask as much as we want Belarusian people to go in the streets, but Belarusian people going in the streets will not change anything, unfortunately. And I think in 2020, we still had this hope that such massive protest mm-hmm. will change something. But I think that has been our best attempt of, mm-hmm. you know, fixing things in a peaceful way. And that attempt failed. And I think with Ukraine right now and with the Russian invasion to Ukraine, we can very clearly see that. I think it's very difficult to underestimate the how painfully Ukraine pays to preserve its lands, preserve its people and preserve its states. But in the end of the day, we see how this very violent counteraction to the Russian aggression really unites Ukrainian people. And I think for many people in Europe, it's quite clear that, you know, there is a war between Ukraine and Russia and we need to support Ukraine because Ukraine is the democratic, liberal, free actor in this war while Russia is not. But when it comes to Belarus, all of a sudden, it's not that clear anymore to outsiders that similar things have been happening. And again, I don't want to say that the Russian war in Ukraine is the same thing that has been happening to Belarus for the last 25 years. Of course not. Like, it's obvious that the Russia has been proactively, violently attacking Ukraine, killing dozens of people, I don't know, doing mass murders of civilians in Ukraine, committing war crimes, committing ecological crimes and ecocide and genocide in Ukraine. Of course, it's different. But the logic and the recognition of the level of severity of situation has been very different in case of Ukraine and in terms of Belarus.
Well, and if to elaborate a little bit further, the difference and the similarities of Belarusian and Ukrainian contexts is also quite obvious. Like the revolution of dignity in Ukraine in 2014 was a violent, was a dreadful clash with the pro-Russian government. I mean, literally, people were killed
exactly
and by snipers from the Russian special forces. And I think it's already a proven fact.
Yeah, I think especially when we talk about Maidan and the revolution of dignity, I think it's very important to highlight that Ukrainians paid the price in like people's life for the freedom and for the independence and for their own way of doing things in their own country. But the first step in that journey was really a violent clash between opposite political forces. And it wasn't a peaceful way of fixing things.
Yeah, exactly. My idea how to compare those two contexts is, in Ukraine, those fight in between two political forces was quite vivid for decades, and it was not clear who is the winner because it was a kind of rotating power structure. Like sometimes it became more pro-Russian, then oppositional forces managed to gain more power and to mobilize people, and it was a violent clash at the end. And then it is much more clear to identify those phases, and the presence of pro-Russian forces is not as much integrated into the whole system as in Belarus, because Belarus, since 1996, when Lukashenko started to corrupt all the power structures in the country, all the checks and balances, the very first step he did was a very clearly pro-Russian integration. I mean, we are not pro-Russian. We are considering ourselves as the very honorable part of this Russian culture heritage. I mean, the citizens of Belarus were forced to survive in the situation of elimination of the language, of the culture, of the democratic freedoms and rights. And it became so much unclear actually exactly this situation of pro-Russian forces, because pro-Russian forces became the integrated part of the state structure as such. I mean, 90% of military top positions in Belarus were either born and raised, got education, one part of it, or all of it in Russia. It means that the level of this so-called integration and what I call occupation is so high that there is no space left for any kind of real battle, real fight in between pro-Russian and anti-Russian. There is basically no such a space, because in the whole structures of the state, every single branch of power is not only pro-Russian, but like
led by people from Russia.
Yeah, I mean, this occupation is invisible because it's kind of exactly, it's being led and governed by the Russian forces inside this kind of camouflaged sovereign country of Belarus. It creates so much frustration for people who live there, because you need constantly, at the same time, imagine yourself as a sovereign state and nation, but at the same time, you see all the evidences of the absence of any kind of independence and sovereignty. And coming back to the protests of 2020 in Belarus, it's for me obvious that if we would have succeeded, like we were actually on the very edge of success, because the whole country was revolting, the whole country was striking. It was just incredibly obvious that it cannot last longer, that this dictatorship is over. I mean, people are not ready to be part of it anymore. And the reason we failed was the clear decision to make it a peaceful movement, to make it a peaceful revolution. Because we, as I would interpret it, we also quite vividly felt that if we step into the field of violence, the Russian part of the apparatus and the military and all the branches of power will not only intervene immediately, and in our case, we actually have already military bases in Belarus. Like, it would be not even an invasion, but the forces inside the country would just say, hello.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm shutting you down. You are dead. And I mean, it's not only because we are so highly developed and in the frames of values, citizens of the very progressive nation. It's also the very self-preservation instinct. Like, we knew it will be the full-scale war, the full-scale civil war in our case, because the presence of Russian powers are so high. And we just wanted to avoid it. We wanted to save as many lives as possible, because it was inevitable otherwise. So my point is, the difference is very clear in between Belarus and Ukraine, even though the similarities are also there. And the fact is now Belarus is de facto is the co-criminal during the full-scale Russian invasion. Our territory was used to invade Ukraine because our borders from Kyiv, it's like 80 kilometers. It's really, really close to the capital of Ukraine. And that's why our territory was used to invade. And that's why all those years Lukashenko is pro-Russian. I mean, not pro-Russian, but really Russian. Because for Putin, it was extremely important to have this land exactly for such a purpose. Yeah, our territory is our main asset and our main danger because we have such a long shared border with Russia. And of course, they cannot leave us alone. It's just not possible. And that's also the difference between Belarus and Finland, because Finland have more options in these geopolitical negotiations and manipulations and leverages than us. Because from one side, we have Russian Empire. And on the other side, we have still quite imperialistic Poland, who would be also, I'm now generalizing, but to make a very short cut, we are also subjected to the imperialistic influence from the West as well. Like, hello, it's too much for just modest and shy Belarusian national identity. It's too much, I'm sorry. Coming back to the context of Belarus, I would really find it crucial to go a little bit into details of how exactly homophobia and transphobia and biphobia altogether with misogyny is being instrumentalized by the regime of Lukashenko. Previously, I mentioned he is very smart into framing his own messages, his own proposals of a paternalistic asshole. But the fact is, at some point, the special forces and the special police against organized crime, which is called GUBOPIK, it might sound like by POC, whatever. It's written GUBOPIK, and it means like special service agency to oppose organized crime. And of course, the organized crime is considered to be people who want to have freedoms and rights. So at some point, the practice of GUBOPIK of filming their victims and publishing it on Telegram in order to terrorize others and to demotivate others to participate into any illegal extremist activities started to include displays of gay men who are confessing on camera that actually they are gay. And it's been made in the very most disrespectful way possible. I mean, the human dignity is completely destroyed by this form of footage. You would see a guy on camera in his own bedroom surrounded by whatever silicone sex toys like dildos and so on. So the level of humiliation being imposed on the human being is so drastic, it's unbelievable. But exactly, homophobia became a new weapon for the dictatorship. And again, if we are comparing this situation to the Russian homophobic laws and the practice of discrimination and violence against LGBTQI people, if you ever open the video being produced by GUBOPIK in Belarus, and you would imagine the level of torture and disrespect and violence against, in particular, LGBTQI people, you would feel shocked. And it's really unimaginable happening in our land. It might be, again, about the image of Belarus as such. Like, if you think about torture, it's something that we experienced after the protest and during the protest of 2020 August, especially when people were gathered, they were detained and they were gathered in one space and they were tortured for hours and hours, being refused of food. And up till now, in prisons, people are refused of basic hygienic
items,
and you are being tortured by the very presence in this space where you cannot sleep normally, when your health is being completely destroyed, your teeth are falling apart, you receive no medical treatment of whatsoever, this is the invisible torture, everyday torture. And in this example of the videos being produced by this special police against organized crime, it is crime. I mean, it's a state crime. It's a state terror. It's a state. I mean, exactly, if we compare the terrorist state of Russia, which is invading the other country's territory, and Belarus is a terrorist state against its own people. That's my idea, is about, like, your video with you is being produced in order to destroy completely your dignity, and the very country lives in this state of terror, and the very image, the very perception of torture is also, should be considered as this forced violent outing, when literally you are threatened with physical violence and long-term imprisonment, and you are forced to say whatever they ask you to say, and they emphasize your identity as a gay man. I mean, this is really the methods of NKVD in the 21st century, nothing else than that.
Yeah, but I also think it's important maybe to mention that it might seem that the videos are published in these pro-state channels and everyone knows that they're pro-state, right? And then the easiest solution could be not to watch them. There are still quite a lot of people in Belarus who watch these videos, right? They might be, and I mean quite a lot of homophobic people in Belarus, right? Mm. They might not be like 100% pro-state, but those are the people who watch, for example, state television, because it's still very well spread in Belarus and people still put on the TV and they watch state channels. They watch this episodes on people being publicly outed, like people being publicly shamed, not only for being, for example, homosexual, but for any other grounds, for example, for being single mother, for a variety of different grounds. I think when you are very critical toward the state and the action of the state, it is quite clear that you have a look at this video and you realize that, okay, this was shot by the pro-state forces and thus is not trustworthy, or you shouldn't continue watching it. But for many people, it's not like that. There are also quite, I would say, a substantial audience from Russia who watches these channels too, especially when it comes to people who do not support any type of democratic transition in Belarus, and those are the ones who are endorsing the Russian invasion to Ukraine. There is a significant audience to all of these videos. And I mean, it might seem not that harmful, but even in mid-term perspective, I think the effects of these videos are really dramatic. I mean, I myself have been subject of a several now pro-state smear campaigns. And I mean, I'm not in the country anymore, but those are typically very explicit type of messaging that they state. For example, they support people like finding you physically, and they endorse the violence, they endorse the rape, for example. And I mean, of course, one can always not read all of that, but unfortunately, you always have to force yourself to do that, because you really need to understand what is going on the other side. Because on the one day, they might only write that, I don't know, you are an ugly lesbian, and the next day they post your personal address on social media and endorse people to visit you in
your apartment.
Did it
really happen so far?
Well, I mean, it happened to
disclosing personal information of activists and address and so on. Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
It never happened to me, but also when we published an announcement on Facebook that we are now married with my husband, one propaganda activist wished us death from AIDS. I mean, that was his
marital wish.
The wish, yeah, we received these congratulations from the state in his, what might be quite sad to hear for all the Western audiences in here. It is not so much different, unfortunately, for many, many European Union states as well. And just, I was really shocked by the recent survey. It was a nationwide survey in Germany, and more than 1,000 men aged between 18 and 35 years were questioned on the matter of violence against women. Ba-ba-ba-bam. 33% of men thought it was acceptable if their hand slipped occasionally during an argument with their female partner. And 34% of respondents admitted that they had been violent towards women in the past. And basically, they feel violence against women is acceptable in some cases.
Yeah. But we all know that once it is acceptable in some cases, typically, it's accepted in all the rest of the cases as well.
Well, that's why I was so shocked, because Germany, for me, is still quite a progressive society, and like the image of Germany is quite different from that. And the additional question was about the display of homosexuality in media. And guess what? 48% of those fragile masculine men are not exactly happy, and they expressed a dislike of public displays of homosexuality, that saying that it disturbed them. Yeah, it brings me to very unity with the whole world. I mean, we really were thinking that in the progressive Western societies, you cannot imagine something like that, but it is actually here and now.
And you failed us, the progressive West. We hoped for you.
Well, exactly. People in the Eastern Europe sometimes are like, oh, there is such a nice blueprint for our future progressive democratic society, and I mean, this very blueprint is a little bit having difficulties of its own, and sometimes even the West is kind of finding it difficult to even articulate those issues, like exactly we produced such a nice image of ourselves, then later it becomes almost impossible to admit the fact we screwed up.
With that said, I think the important lesson that we can all learn from here is that I think all across Europe we have seen that the far-right political forces have been on the uprise. So the more conservative governments are taking over the power, there are more far-right and right extremist political groups in Europe. And I think us, coming from extremely close to civil society, almost demolished democratic structures, we have a lot to share on how to try to combat these forces, because we have been doing this all alone for almost 25 years now. And I think this is a very important moment when we can actually show solidarity and stand up for the values that we actually have in common. And that is why I think it is important to organize the space physically, but also like mentally, intellectually, to try to discuss the experiences that we have. Because when we see Europe being divided between Western and Eastern Europe, it is very easy to dismiss expertise and skills and knowledge coming from Eastern Europe as something that has very little relevance to the Western Europe. People in Eastern Europe, they live in their own context, in their own societies, and they do not necessarily have, I don't know, added value to the conversation, you know, because they didn't have these fully developed democratic structures, they didn't live up to the full democratic or social progressive potential, and so on. In fact, we have been struggling with the same type of conservatism, same type of political rigidity for a very long time, and we actually have right now a quite extensive toolbox to share on what potentially can be done in
exactly.
relation to
it
that.
Exactly, it gives us a little bit even more credibility in the situation, and the reality is we are deprived of actual like agency in this conversation as such, which should be reversed, reformed or changed at least. But if we continue talking about this correlations and interesting links in between global disasters and the reasons behind, I would still also refer to this neo-colonial picture of the world and the very fact, not only mentally and emotionally, there is a lot of kind of sympathy towards Russia in Europe. Like, don't make Putin angry because Germany has such a guilt after the Second World War, and this guilt is only being extrapolated on Russia, but for some reason not on Ukraine and Belarus, even though Belarus and Ukraine suffered most, I mean, percentage of the population which was killed during Second World War, and the fact that our territories were mostly used as battlefields is kind of forgotten, and it all goes to Russia because Russia is an inheritance of Soviet Union, and this creates a very stupid misinterpretation of reality, because Soviet Union was never Russia. Russia was trying to control all the lands around all the countries and to make it Russian, to make it even more similar. The aim was to erase all the nations, all the countries, all the cultures around. And then we are the victims of the Soviet Empire, I mean Belarus and Ukraine. And now all the guilt from Germany, for instance, goes towards Russia. Like, I mean, I'm talking here about rather some kind of stereotypical perceptions in the German society, and also some politicians are affected by it still, even though, I mean, it's so ridiculous. And when you hear in Germany, even some politicians speaking, they say, they are Ukraine, which is like the Ukraine. And the same I see in my documentaries about the Second World War and so on. The Ukraine. What the fuck is wrong with you guys? Why would you refer to the sovereign independent country as the region part of something like Russia, which is exactly the case in Russia? They exactly refer to Ukraine as the region of their own land. And you are copy-pasting this very imperialistic colonial approach into your own context. And that creates exactly this sympathy and kind of unrest about providing heavy arms to Ukraine. And it creates a lot of frustration. And we are losing time and we are losing lives of Ukrainian people. I mean, this is crazy. I cannot understand why it happens.
As you can see, Belarus is quite complex, right? So it has its own very diverse history. It has its own very complex relations with the Russian Empire, previously with the Soviet Union, and currently with Russia. And it's not very easy to distinguish Belarusian history, both past and present, and queer history in Belarus, past and present. Those are two very interconnected topics, and the geopolitical, political, economical, social and cultural developments that have been happening in Belarus are intrinsically connected to the experiences of queer people in Belarus. We really hope that this episode helped you to understand a little bit more of how it is to live as a queer individual in Belarus. If you have any motivation after listening to all of this to contribute somehow to queer communities in Belarus, please do the following steps. First step is find your local Belarusian diaspora in your country or in your city. And typically, Belarusians are always collecting money because there are so many people who suffered trauma, either from imprisonment or from the tortures in the state, that we're constantly trying to rehabilitate our people. If you have the capacity and if you have the financial resources, please consider donating to Belarus. Please continue supporting the fight for freedom that Ukraine does. We, Belarusian queer, stand in solidarity with Ukraine and wish Ukraine swift victory. Step number three. Please continue spreading information about Belarus and what is happening in there. The drastic developments of 2020 hasn't stopped in Belarus, and we're still experiencing very severe state and political persecution in the country. There are still people on the ground who are doing an amazing job in sustaining our communities and sustaining the fight, and they really need international support. We hope you enjoyed this, and please stay tuned for next episodes.
This podcast is brought together by Tony Lashton, Andrei Zavale, and Albert, aka Scarlett. Please feel free to contact us. We are excited to receive your feedback. Stay tuned, listen to other episodes of our podcast, tell your friends about us, and we wish you the very best, pederesque, queerish, faggotish day.